welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, September 27. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting another mostly sunny day. Winds will be from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour, and Cedar Rapids will see a high of 87. We'll climb to 88 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low tonight of 54 in Cedar Rapids, 57 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 6:55 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., for a total daylight period of 11 hours and 56 minutes. And from today's front page, 2 weeks into the academic year, Iowa City teachers are shifted from classrooms and schools, a story by Grace King of the Gazette staff. Grant Easton is finally back in the classroom after about 18 months of learning from home between March 2020 and mid-August 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But 2 weeks into the school year, Grant, age 11, was moved to a different sixth grade teacher. His class went from 17 students to almost 30, a traumatic experience for him, his mother, Brooke Easton, said. During the first 2 weeks of school, some Iowa City teachers were shifted to different grade levels or even different schools to accommodate for the needs of the population at each building. The district uses the weighted resource allocation model to control class sizes based on rates of students who face barriers in their education. For example, if 70% or more students in a classroom receive free or reduced price lunch, that class size will be smaller than a classroom that has fewer than 70%. Class sizes matter, said Amy Kortemeyer, Iowa City Schools Deputy Superintendent. They're important to our staff, to parents, to students, and we want to provide a safe, welcoming learning environment. We believe that the weighted resource allocation model does that. Six of Iowa City schools' 370 classrooms, including two classes at Horn Elementary and one at Wickham Elementary School, were affected by the weighted resource allocation model after the first day of school this year. The last staff shift for elementary schools was on August 31, Kortemeyer said. Grant was super psyched to be back in school. He had a desk in the corner of the room and felt safe with social distancing and wearing a mask. But when other students joined the class, Easton said Grant was crying and yelling when she picked him up from school that he wanted to do school online. He felt like people are breathing down his neck, coughing on him. There's too many people, Easton said. The classroom was not built to accommodate almost 30 students, especially during a pandemic, she said. There has to be a solution that works, not only for the school budget, but to give kids and teachers consistency, Easton said. There is no Iowa law that places a cap on class sizes, said Heather Doe, Iowa Department of Education Communications Director. There are five levels of the weighted resource allocation model, with level one being the smallest class size. Last year, all Iowa City school buildings were at a weighted resource allocation model between levels 2 and 5. This year, all Iowa City schools are at a weighted resource allocation model between levels 1 and 4, with the help of elementary and secondary school emergency relief funding from the U.S. Department of Education and the American Rescue Plan. Level 4 for kindergarten is 24 students, 26 students for first and second grades, and 30 students for third through sixth grades, for example. Everyone got bumped down, Kortemeyer said. Ideally, we wouldn't want to have to use even a weighted resource allocation model level 4, but it's what we could afford to do. Kortemeyer said she understands the heartache that can be caused when a student is placed with a different teacher. But we do believe this is the most equitable approach to take, so we have buildings staffed accordingly, Kortemeyer said. There always is some shift in what classrooms and even teachers are placed each year, Kortemeier said, but most of the work happens before the first day of school. The number of students enrolled in the K-12 Iowa City Community School District online program also is affecting in-person class sizes, Kortemeier said. There are about 900 students enrolled in the virtual academy, rolled out for the first time this year. The district held two enrollment periods over the summer and opened a third period in August to give families an online learning option as the Delta variant of COVID-19 rapidly spread across the state. During that time, the number of students enrolled in the online school almost doubled, Kortemeier said. In the online program, there are 477 students in kindergarten through grade 6, 97 students in grades 7 through 8, and 178 students in grades 9 through 12. William Fulmer, age 11, a sixth grader at Horn Elementary School, wrote to the school board and superintendent Matt Degner after he was placed with a new teacher 2 weeks into the school year. In an email to Degner, shared with the Gazette, William wrote that he would love, love, love it if the superintendent could make his original teacher teach his sixth grade class again. I was angry, a bit emotional, William said. I wanted to make sure my voice was heard and wanted to let them know how I felt in that situation. While William said he hasn't received a response from school board members, he has struck up a friendship with Degner. I'm so sorry this change has affected you and for your sadness, Degner wrote to William in an email shared with the Gazette. We're trying to help students in other schools in the district. Keep being great and have a good year. Robin Fulmer, William's mother, said it was traumatic for him. He came home crying. In that short amount of time, he got to know his teacher really well and felt safe, she said. Leslie Austin has three daughters in Iowa City schools. Sophia, age 12, at Northwest Junior High, and Josie, age 11, and Claire, 7, at the Wickham Elementary School. Josie's fifth grade class was combined with another class a few days into the school year, going from about 20 students to 30. I know her teacher is wonderful, fabulous, and amazing, but I know you can't teach 30 kids the same way you'd be able to teach 25, said Austin, who is a substitute teacher, especially where some of them missed in-person fourth grade. I don't understand the disruption and why it's okay to do this to kids and teachers, Austin said. Chris Nance's children are in fifth and third grade at Wickham Elementary School. His son Grayson, age 10, a fifth grader, was placed with a new teacher 2 weeks into the school year, and about 10 students were added to his class. Large class sizes make it harder to social distance, Nance said. We're worried about them getting COVID-19, and we would hope they would get more individualized attention in a smaller class. Nance also is counting down the days until his kids can be vaccinated. We'd go get it at 3 o'clock if it was approved at 2:41 p.m., Nance said. There's no reason on God's green earth why anyone shouldn't get vaccinated. Also from today's front page, only one can speak for a school board. Cedar Rapids policy curbs public comments from members. President speaks for all, a story by Grace King of the Gazette staff. Most emails to Cedar Rapids school board members about school resource officers have gone unanswered over the last few months as the board prepares to vote on a revised agreement between this district and the Cedar Rapids Police Department or police in schools. The board is relying on a long-standing practice of having the board president serve as a spokesperson for the consensus of the board, discouraging the other six elected members from addressing the public. The board president will set the tone of the board meetings and, as the representative of the consensus of the board, speak on behalf of the board to the public, State School Board Procedure 202.2C. Before school board meetings, the president consults with the superintendent and board secretary. Randy Evans, executive director for the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, said he understands the school board's desire to have one person serving as the spokesperson for all seven. But voters deserve to have their questions answered by their board members and to hear their board members articulate the reasons they support or oppose a proposal, Evans said in an email. Multiple board members declined to comment when contacted by the Gazette, instead referring questions to the board president and the district spokeswoman. Any attempt to silence or sanction a board member who speaks out should be roundly rejected by residents of the district, Evans said. The absence of responses from board members and the lack of discussion at board meetings could lead to the conclusion that decisions are being made before the board's meetings. School districts are governed by the entire board, Evans said. A policy like this one leaves the public to think there are attempts ongoing to gag some members of the board, he said. The Gazette has been asked multiple times to turn to a staff member, District Communications Director Colleen Scholler, when asking questions of an elected school board member. On August 30, a reporter sent a request for comments from Board President Nancy Humbles to Scholler. In an email later that day, reviewed by the Gazette, Scholler asked Superintendent Noreen Bush to pass the newsletter's questions on to Humbles. And Noreen, will you send the related board questions to Nancy Humbles? Please let me know her response, Scholler emailed Bush at 10:05 p.m. August 30. The board made an open records request to the district asking for communication to and from Bush, Deputy Superintendent Nicole Koecker, and Climate and Culture Transformation Director Justin Blights related to the school resource officers issue between July 1 and August 31. A second open records request for the same time period asked for all communications received by and responses made by members of the Cedar Rapids School Board related to school resource officers. The school officer program, which data from the state shows has disproportionately led to arrests of black students, has come under wide scrutiny and attracted dozens of speakers at board meetings. In hundreds of emails reviewed by the Gazette, only a few board members, including Jennifer Borcherding and Scott Riesinger, emailed questions about the school resource officer program to district officials. Little discussion has taken place publicly at the board table to give direction to the district staff on how to proceed with changes to the school resource officer program. The district has been reviewing the program that places police officers at seven Cedar Rapids schools since June. A school board agenda released Friday includes an item on an amended agreement for the program, but the text of the agreement is not being publicly released until this afternoon. The board meeting is at 5:30 p.m. today at the Educational Leadership and Support Center at 2500 Edgewood Road Northwest. Proposals made previously include removing full-time officers from middle schools, having officers wear a soft uniform to be more approachable, and steering officers to seek diversion options for first offenses where possible. In addition, proposals suggest that schools not involve officers in enforcing school rules or discipline, and that officers not listen to the questioning of students by school officials unless asked for safety. Kevin Wymore, a Cedar Rapids resident, filed his own public records request from the district to get more information about how the district is making decisions about the future of the school resource officer program. Wymore, a 1976 graduate of Kennedy High School, said the district first asked him to pay $414 for the public records. He ended up paying $10. In his own inquiries, Wymore said, Board President Humbles has been hard to get information from. Other board members did not answer his questions. No one has spoken to me, he said. Turning to today's Insight page, we have a column by Petula Dvorak, who is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post. Her piece is entitled, Immigrants Help Retirees, So the Retirees Decided to Help Them. Augustine Taylor is there when the garbage disposal snarls, when the internet quits, when the lights fade and flicker. Whenever the senior citizens living at Goodwin House pick up the phone, 46-year-old Taylor saves the day. His lilting accent, the sound of their apartment's salvation. The accent? Sierra Leone, he tells them. And because that's what they hear so often, the sounds of Sierra Leone, Cameroon, Haiti, Jamaica, these residents decided to do something extraordinary for the migrants who take such good care of them, who treat their senior status with an honor and value that our youth-worshipping, throwaway culture too often neglects. One of every four workers in long-term care facilities are immigrants. They are about 17% of the nation's entire medical workforce. Thanks to the forces of economics and geopolitics, most of the folks taking care of us, our parents and our grandparents, are the world's migrants. And even more are needed, especially as we plunge deeper into the pandemic and the healthcare workforce becomes more strained. It's a crisis, said Ann Stewart, age 79, a resident at Goodwin House in a suburban part of Northern Virginia called Bailey's Crossroads, who loves talking to the workers to learn about their lives. And what are we doing? Stewart said before pulling down her mask so I could hear her stage whisper. We're deporting them. So they decided to help in the best way they could, with one resident, Rita Siebenaller, leading an effort that turned nearly 90 employees of the Goodwin Houses in Bailey Crossroads and in Alexandria into nearly 90 new American citizens. Siebenaller, 78, is well-versed in the immigrant struggle as a social worker who counseled in Thailand, Germany, and Russia throughout her career. And she was shocked when she read that the path to U.S. citizenship was becoming even more difficult because fees were increasing for immigrants. The cost of filing the primary citizenship form, the N-400, went from $95 in 1994 to $640 in 2016. And then the Trump administration proposed to nearly double that to $1,170. A federal judge blocked that increase, but at $725, it's still a big number for folks struggling to get a foothold in a new life. My grandmother came here as an indentured servant, and I couldn't find anywhere that she even paid a fee, Siebenaller said, and we felt this was just wrong. So she proposed that residents help pay the citizenship fees for the immigrants who take care of their apartments, cook their food, and take care of their medical needs. She ran into some bureaucracy issues, but used diplomacy and her wits to get around the roadblocks and found a champion in the Goodwin House administration. Within 2 weeks, she raised $40,000 from residents and had the full backing of the community's administration to promote her plan. And the residents raised their hands to volunteer. They tutored the health aides, housekeepers, and cooks, drilling them on spelling, the constitutional amendments, the writers of the Federalist Papers, the rights of U.S. citizens, and other questions on the citizenship test that huge percentages of American-born citizens who call themselves patriots would flunk. The head of the Goodwin House Foundation, Valerie Burke, is trying to promote the program to other retirement communities, to folks who may need a little guidance in understanding the potential for connections and mutual enrichment. Alexandra helped me study, said Miranda Tangi, age 33, naming the resident who tutored her for her citizenship exam. Tanji had studied to be a teacher in her native Cameroon, but teachers weren't treated so nicely back there. She decided to enter the lottery for a U.S. visa, and she got a spot, but would have to leave her twins behind in her mother's care. She took a chance. "I want a good life for them," she said. 6 years later, she's a beloved caregiver in the Goodwin House Hospice Program, received tuition assistance from Goodwin House for classes and certification, is scheduled to take her oath of citizenship next week, and is looking for an affordable home for herself and her twin boys, who are now 7 years old. "The people are always smiling and so kind to us here," she said, "and they changed my life." The groundskeeper from Haiti told them how much he loves all their smiles. "I want to live here when I retire," Wilmer Vialler told them. The cafeteria worker from Jamaica said she never had grandparents growing up, "but I have so many grandparents now," Nicola Stevens told the residents who helped her, who nagged her to study as her citizenship test came up. There was something comfortable about the way the workers and residents mingled after the citizenship ceremony the Goodwin House folks threw for their new citizens earlier this month. They know one another's kids and grandkids. They share stories. They're not oceans apart. Siebenhaller boiled it down for me, the rapport between these two seemingly disparate groups of people. The immigrants want to be in a place where they are valued, and in a nation where families can be separated by hundreds or thousands of miles, where the elderly are often warehoused and forgotten, the senior citizens are looking for the same thing, to be valued. Many of them come from cultures where seniors are more revered than they are here, she said. It's mutually beneficial. And that piece by Petula Dvorak of the Washington Post. And we have two community letters today, the first coming from Jim Walters of Iowa City. Jim's piece is entitled, "What Would Continuous Tax Cuts Do to Iowa?" John Hendrickson's guest column, 2022 should be a great year for taxpayers on September 19, says Iowa's goal should be to continuously lower tax rates. Really? Presumably until there are no taxes at all? Until we have no funds for roads, public schools, parks, and green space, for taking care of the needy, the elderly, and the infirm? Hendrickson's world is without any sense of community, one reserved only for the rich. It's a world without love or social consciousness. I don't want to live in the kind of world John Hendrickson envisions. That piece by Jim Walters of Iowa City. The next letter is entitled, "Rushed Legislation Sparked Fight Over School Masking." It's a letter by David Dewar of Iowa City. As the number of new COVID-19 cases continues to climb in Iowa, with the largest percentage, 29%, of those cases among the 17 and younger age group, we continue to question whether we should limit the spread of the coronavirus by requiring mask wearing in our K-12 schools. Our school-age children are vulnerable to the coronavirus because many of them cannot be vaccinated. Although evidence indicates that the virus is rarely fatal among this age group, these children can still carry the virus home to their families, where the effects can be far more serious. Lawsuits have been brought by families arguing that Iowa's law prohibiting K-12 schools from issuing mask mandates denies their children with disabilities and illnesses the right to an education in a safe environment. A U.S. District Court judge has now temporarily halted the law as these lawsuits are being reviewed. At this point, it's worth recalling how this law came to be. A bill was introduced in the Iowa legislature on May 19. Republican Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker and House Speaker Pat Grassley push that bill through at lightning speed with minimal opportunity for discussion or public input, and passed it in both chambers by that evening. GOP Governor Kim Reynolds signed the bill into law shortly after midnight, May 20. The actions of these leaders suggest that individual choice is more important than the health and welfare of the whole. Please remember their names during our next election cycle. That piece by David Dewar of Iowa City. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, September 27, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. From Brooklyn, Maynard John Lang, age 95, passed away in his home on September 24. A private family committal was held. His ashes were interred next to his wife, Dorothy, and also at the dairy farm where he lived. From Iowa City, Peggy Ann Whitehill Ostrom, a resident of Iowa City for 70 years, passed away on Monday, February 24. A memorial service will be held at 5 p.m. Friday, October 1, at the Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service at 605 Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City, where visitation will begin at 3 p.m. A family committal service was held at Memory Gardens Cemetery in Iowa City. And from Cedar Rapids, Tristan Novak, age 17, died unexpectedly Thursday, September 23, after a long struggle with mental health. A eulogy ceremony will take place at 4 p.m. Wednesday, September 29, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life gathering will follow from 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood. From Cedar Rapids, Alan Frederick Young, age 93, died on September 24 in Huntersville, North Carolina. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 29, at the Cedar Memorial Funeral Home and Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service is at 11 a.m. Thursday, September 30, at Zion Lutheran Church in Hiawatha. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial, with a luncheon afterward at the funeral home. From Cedar Rapids, Carl Richard Young, age 65, died Friday, September 24, at his home. A visitation is from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, September 28, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. No other services will be held. From Central City, Frances Ellen Graybow Sauer, age 81, passed away on Saturday, September 25. A funeral service is at 11 a.m. Wednesday, September 29, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Marion. And visitation is from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesday, September 28, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Marion. A private interment at a later date in the Jordan's Grove Cemetery. From Coggin, Joanne Kim Price, age 80, passed away on Friday, September 24, at the Mercy Medical Center. A prayer service will be held at 3:30 p.m. Monday, September 27, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with visitation to follow from 4 to 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, September 28, at the Peace Lutheran Church in Ryan. Burial will take place following services at the Coggin Cemetery. From Manchester, Eva Evelyn Meter, age 89, passed away at her home on Thursday, September 23. A memorial service is at 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 28, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Visitation is from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 27, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. And interment is in Oakland Cemetery, also in Manchester. From Marion, Jean Ann, also known as Jan Todd, died on September 24. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, September 28, at the Cedar Valley Bible Church in Cedar Rapids. A private entombment will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 27, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. From Mechanicsville, Bernard E. Andrew, age 85, passed away on Saturday, September 25, at the Clarence Nursing Home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 29, at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudoun. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. Burial will follow in the Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. From Mechanicsville, Jean E. Davidson died on Sunday, September 26, at the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon. Graveside service is at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, September 28, at Rose Hill Cemetery in Mechanicsville. A celebration of Jean's life will be held at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon is caring for Jean and her family. From Palo, Thomas Wayne Clymer, age 61, died at home in his sleep on Friday, September 24. A celebration of life will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Saturday, October 9, at his sister Tamara's house at 505 Main Street in Palo. The Tian Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. From Seattle, Washington, Donna Mathis died after a brief illness at the University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle on September 19 at age 52. A celebration of her life will be announced at a later date. And in our other death notices from Arlington, Sheila B. Manis, age 70, died Sunday, September 26. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Arlington is assisting the family. From Greeley, George Joseph Amling, age 55, died Sunday, September 26. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Edgewood is assisting the family. From Keystone, Judy Ann Meyer Piper, age 68, died Friday, September 24. The Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone is assisting the family. And from Shoeyville, Jim Chalupski, age 71, died Saturday, September 25. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And from Tipton, Maxine S. Ehlers, age 92, died Saturday, September 25. The Fry Funeral Home in Tipton is assisting the family. And from Tipton, Michael O'Neill, age 77, died Saturday, September 25. The Fry Funeral Home in Tipton is assisting the family. Finally, from Van Horn, Edward, also known as Ed Rudnick, age 57, died Thursday, September 23. The Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have an Iowa, University of Iowa football story entitled Curse of the Mobile QB. Hawks struggled at times containing CSU's Centeio, by John Stepp of the Gazette staff. Most fans are probably pleased with Iowa's second half against Colorado State. The first half, not so much. That leaves a lot to dissect ahead of the resumption of Iowa's Big Ten football schedule. On paper, Iowa's run defense looked great. Colorado State's rushing attack had at least 200 yards in two of its first three games. The Hawkeyes held the Rams to a season-low 25 rushing yards on Saturday. Great, right? Well, yes and no. The Rams were without starting running back David Bailey for almost all of Saturday. After Bailey ran for 2 yards less than a minute into the game, he hobbled to the sideline and did not return. Regardless of who was running the ball, Iowa's defensive front, whether it be veterans like John Wagner or newer faces like Yaha Black largely won the battle at the line of scrimmage. But Iowa struggled to stop quarterback Todd Senteo from making big plays on his feet, particularly in the first half. A lot of his runs happened at seemingly the worst times for the Hawkeyes, too. Four of Colorado State's 9 third-down conversions in the first half came from Senteo runs. On a 3rd-and-4 in the first quarter, Iowa's 6-man rush was effective. The secondary had solid coverage of the Rams' receiving corps, including star tight end Trey McBride. Senteo outran most of Iowa's 4-3 defensive front, though, for 9 yards and a first down. About a minute later, Colorado State faced another third down, this time with 7 yards to go. Iowa again provided pressure. Defensive end Joe Evans pierced through the C-gap quickly. Teammate Zach Van Valkenburg wasn't far behind. Senteo extended the play with his feet before finding an open E.J. Scott for a 17-yard completion. It didn't go in the box score as a quarterback run, but the conversion wouldn't have been a lot less likely without Senteo's scramble to the right side. In the second quarter, Iowa's defense stopped Colorado State on first and second downs after a shanked punt gave the Rams the ball on Iowa's 35-yard line. Senteo's run for 15 yards extended the drive, which ended with another Senteo run on another third down for a touchdown. Senteo had a 10-yard run early in the third quarter that was negated by a holding call. The senior quarterback was limping after the play. He remained in the game but did not have another run for more than 1 yard after he started limping. Iowa hasn't seen much of a quarterback who also is a significant running threat this season. Its first 3 opponents' quarterbacks combined to record minus 14 rushing yards. This might not be the last Iowa sees of quarterbacks making plays on their feet. The Hawkeyes' next 2 opponents, Maryland and Penn State, don't have quarterbacks who rely on their feet nearly as much as Senteo does, but they have shown the ability to do so when necessary. Maryland quarterback Taulia Tagovailoa had a 35-yard run against Illinois, although he hasn't run for 10 or more yards in the Terrapins' other 3 wins. Penn State's Sean Clifford, meanwhile, had a 43-yard run against Ball State and a 20-yard run against then number 22 Auburn. Quarterback Spencer Petras had just completed 6 straight passes and brought the Hawkeyes into the red zone for the first time on Saturday. With less than 2 minutes left in the half, Iowa had a prime opportunity to take a halftime lead. Petras' attempt at 7 straight completions was too ambitious, though, and came at a big cost. After play action, he tried needling a throw to wide receiver Tyrone Tracy, who was running a tunnel screen. Colorado State defensive back Robert Floyd intercepted it and ran 62 yards to set up a Rams drive that eventually ended in a touchdown and a 14-7 lead. Forcing that throw likely resulted in a 10 or 14-point swing, and Petras' streak of 167 throws without an interception ended. Dear Abby's column today is entitled "Aging Mother's Life Doesn't Include Daughter." Dear Abby, I'm nearing 57 and single. My mother, who is 78, lives in the same apartment complex. I always try to talk with her because we don't have much time together. All she wants to do is watch TV and read the paper. She allows me to talk to her for about a half an hour a day, then she has to go. If I visit her, she can only talk to me for a few minutes. Then she has to put the TV on. I feel like I must beg her to talk with me. When I approached her about it, she says she's living her life how she wants to, basically without me. Because of that, I've decided to give up and spend only Christmas and her birthday with her. If you have any advice, I would like to see it. Signed, her sad, hurt daughter. And Abby responds, a half-hour phone call every day may be too much for your mother to handle. That she has to limit your calls to 30 minutes tells me you would like them to be even longer. Rather than punish her by distancing yourself and seeing her only twice a year, limit those visits and phone conversations to twice a week. I think it would be healthier for both of you if you find a way to become less emotionally dependent upon your mother. Also, plan some outings away from the apartment complex for you and your mother to share. And from today's community page, we have an article entitled More Room for Respite, Iowa City Catholic Worker to Buy Second House Near Downtown, a story by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette staff. When the Catholic Worker House opened in Iowa City in 2016, co-founder David Goodner told the Gazette, "We're just getting started." 5 years later, the organization is poised to buy a second house, a 5,000 square foot Victorian, most recently serving as a bed and breakfast, to house other immigrants and people in need. When people are in that desperate situation where they have nowhere to go, it's so difficult to turn them away, said Kim Novak, a volunteer for the Catholic Worker House. But we've been at max capacity at the Sycamore Street House for so long. The new house is at 113 South Johnson Street. Will more than double the Catholic Worker House's overnight capacity and provide a second hub closer to the jobs and services in downtown Iowa City. It's going to feel really good to help a few more of these people, Novak said. The house they are buying now is called the Burford House Inn, a 1903 house previously owned by artist Byron Burford and his wife Kay. Mark McCallum, age 61, bought the house in 2013 and renovated it over a year before opening it as a bed and breakfast in 2014. He added bathrooms to each of the five guest rooms and updated wiring, plumbing, and heating and air conditioning systems, the Gazette reported in 2016. He turned the attic into a suite, complete with a small living room, kitchenette, and a gas fireplace. There are seven bathrooms in the house, McCallum told the Gazette this past week. There are not that many seven-bathroom houses in town. When McCallum listed the house earlier this year, he wasn't sure who would be interested in such a unique property. McCallum also renovated and operated the Brown Street Inn for several years. Although McCallum kept the Burford House Inn afloat financially during the COVID-19 pandemic, it was a time for reflection after four family members contracted the virus. I was revisiting my faith and had started praying again for those family members, he said. It was kind of weird, the one active person coming to look at my for sale house was affiliated with the Catholic Church. McCallum learned about the Catholic Worker Mission, which involves volunteers providing their communities with works of mercy, including feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, clothing the naked, sheltering the homeless, and visiting the sick and imprisoned. In recent years, the Catholic Worker House has become a respite for immigrants from Mexico, Central America, Africa, and elsewhere. Our goal with immigrants is we have them until they have an opportunity to set their kids up in schools, understand transportation, understand where they can work. That sometimes can take a year, Novak said. This does become their home for a year while we assist them with those services. The house also is open several days a week for showers, laundry, and meals for other Iowa City residents in need. Catholic Worker volunteers have become vocal advocates for providing COVID-19 relief aid to undocumented workers and others who have not been eligible for for earlier rounds of funding. McCallum realized Burford House Inn, with space on the first floor for gatherings, privacy for families, and College Green Park right across the street, was the perfect fit for the Catholic worker. They needed everything I did, he said of his renovations. Buying a property that costs nearly $1 million is a stretch for the Catholic Worker House, volunteers said. But the group paid off its first house at 1414 Sycamore Street in less than 5 years and has already secured most of the needed down payment for the Burford House. Some of the larger contributions, including $10,000 from Green State Credit Union and an unspecified amount from the Sisters of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin Mary. There is still about $175,000 to raise before the group closes on the new house on December 27. For more information, go to the Iowa City Catholic Worker website at iowacitycatholicworker.org or contact the Community Foundation of Johnson County at cfjc.org. And we have several things to do today. The first is a museum exhibit entitled Band 141, 140 Years of Hawkeye Marching Excellence. You can view a significant collection of materials from the Hawkeye Marching Band's history, including photographs, drill charts, uniform pieces, audio and video recordings, and more. It's from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. at the Voxman Music Building at 93 East Burlington Street in Iowa City. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And then we have a piece entitled Mother Goose on the Loose. It's a virtual nursery rhyme program for newborns to three-year-olds from the Cedar Rapids Public Library at 9:30 a.m. It's online at www.crlibrary.org. The cost is free, and it's also for all ages. And we have a health and fitness activity entitled Metta Yoga with Prairie Woods. Experience the healing powers of meditative yoga in a spiritual and natural environment. People of all fitness levels and abilities are encouraged to participate. For more information or to register, contact Heather at Harbaugh, that's H-A-R-B-A-U-G-H, at hotmail.com or call 319-389-1463. It's at 9:30 a.m. at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center at 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The cost is $99 for an 11-punch card or $60 for a 6-punch card, 1 punch per session. It's for all ages. And another museum exhibit entitled Meditations on Movements on Moments in the Landscape. Drawing on familiar scenes from the back roads of his native eastern Iowa, artist Fred Isker explores both the aesthetics and the character of the place, offering a keen meditation on the power, vulnerability, and eloquence of the land. It's from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Gilded Pear Gallery at 808 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free, and it's for all ages. And we have Gelly Plate Printmaking. Using a gel plate, images can be transferred to paper using a brayer. Come learn about the basics of printmaking in this one-night class. Masks are not required but are recommended for those who are not vaccinated. Tickets are available through www.easterniowaartsacademy.org or you can call 319-350-1805 during business hours to register. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Eastern Iowa Arts Academy at 1841 E Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is $30 and the fee includes all materials required for the class. and it's for all ages. Here are your Eastern Iowa briefs for today. The first is entitled, Iowa Trail Summit is online this October with 3 webinars. The Iowa Trails Summit is online for this year. 3 webinars during the month of October will bring together trailblazers from across Iowa to learn, connect, and collaborate. Professional and volunteer trail advocates alike are welcome. The webinars are Friday on October 1, October 15, and October 29. People can attend one webinar or register for the whole series. The cost is $10 per session or $25 for all 3. All sessions will be held via Zoom from 2:30 to 4 p.m. Central Time. Registration is required and space is limited. Recordings will only be made available to registered attendees. You can register at iowatrailssummit.com/register. On October the 1st, the title is New Program and Innovative Ways to Find Money and Retain Donors for Your Trail. We often look to each other for best practices to find money for our trails, but there's a lot to be learned from others outside our network. Learn from panelists familiar with proposed federal funding programs, private fundraising campaigns, and donor stewardship management. On October 15, the title is Making Your Trail More Inclusive. Trails are free fitness facilities open to all our neighbors and visitors. Are you doing all you can to ensure everyone feels welcome? Creating an inclusive environment not only brings more people to communities, but also creates a larger network of supporters and advocates. Learn how to view a planned or existing trail project through an equitable lens, as well as what more can be done to invite new communities and partners to a project. On October 29, the webinar is entitled Programming and Promoting Your Trail. The past 2 years continue to prove the importance of outdoor recreation and green space. How do we leverage this momentum, continue to build champions for our trails, and increase the number of visitors to our communities? Learn how to build successful programs and campaigns that shine a light on your project. For more information, visit iowatrailssummit.com. And the Cedar Rapids Community Orchestra seeks new members. The Cedar Rapids Community Orchestra has resumed and is looking for new members as it welcomes new conductor Dr. Gios Zadea for the 2021-2022 season. The orchestra was formed in 2013 and always is looking for musicians. People who performed in high school or college orchestras are invited to join and relive the joy of playing music with others, as well as musicians who want to try playing in a larger group setting. All may join and no auditions are required. The orchestra meets at 7 p.m. Mondays at Cedar Hills Community Church at 6455 E Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids. More information is available at www.crcorchestra.org. All string players, woodwind, brass, and percussionists are welcome to round out the full orchestra. The orchestra has 2 concerts per year, and its repertoire ranges from classical music to current hits. And our pet of the week is M&M. M&M is a small 10-year-old domestic male short hair mix available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society at 7411 Mount Vernon Road Southeast. M&M, who is sweet and gets along well with other cats, was brought in after his owner no longer was able to care for him and several other cats. Call 319-362-6288 for more information. And from Iowa City, we learned that two fall Hampshire shows have been canceled. The pandemic prompts Boston Pops and Bill Irwin to call off events. The continuing pandemic has led to two upcoming events at Hampshire Auditorium, October 27's Boston Pops and the November 5 performance by clown and comedian Bill Irwin, being canceled. In a video announcement, Hampshire Executive Director Chuck Swanson said the Boston Pops had canceled their tour, which included the performance in Iowa City, and that the venue was not able to meet the requirements of the Actors Union that represents Irwin. For those who have already bought tickets to either event, the Hampshire box office said it would send a refund by check or by crediting a card used to make the purchase. And our top weather story today is entitled Warming Climate Leads to Decline in Crops. A warming climate is leading to productivity changes in corn and soybeans. Extreme heat and drought are combining to cause damage. The higher temperatures result in a higher moisture demand from the crops. With lower precipitation and a lower moisture supply, crops wilt and lower yields are the result. According to Climate Central, much of southern and eastern Iowa are expected to see a decline in bushels per acre of corn production over the second half of this century. Soybean production is expected to drop nationwide during the same time, with the largest declines in states to Iowa's south, but with the largest economic impacts expected along the Missouri and Mississippi River valleys. And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, Monday, September 27. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.